It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some big news on auto recalls in the last 2 days affecting Toyota and GM. We'll catch up on the latest and find out why recalls happen.
But first, we're continuing our 3-day series on heroin use in Wisconsin. The number of heroin cases processed by crime labs has risen steadily in every county in Wisconsin over the last 3 years. The number of heroin-related deaths is also on the rise.
Many people start using heroin after becoming addicted to prescription painkillers. Drugs like OxyContin and hydrocodone end up being more expensive and harder to get than heroin on the street.
Heroin has united lawmakers on both sides of the aisle in the Wisconsin legislature. Earlier this year, four heroin-related bills passed the Wisconsin State Assembly unanimously, something that's rare these days in Wisconsin politics. Several heroin-related bills have gotten bipartisan support, and they're waiting for Governor Walker's signature.
The lawmaker behind this legislation is Republican State Representative John Nygren. He represents the 89th District, which includes Marinette and Oconto counties. He was with us here in the studio to talk about his heroin legislation and what work still needs to be done to address the opiate problem here in Wisconsin. Representative Nygren, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with your personal experience. We hear again and again, including from our guest yesterday, a story that starts with prescription painkillers, either prescribed legally or obtained illegally, ultimately leading to heroin. Is that the story of your daughter?
That's consistent. It's consistent with my daughter's story. It's consistent with her friends. We actually had a doctor in Menominee, Michigan, who was selling prescriptions for OxyContin on the streets, and that contributed to the problem. When he got arrested, got sent to prison, the source dried up. Right around the same time, they reformulated the OxyContin so it couldn't be crushed and snorted as easily. And the folks addicted moved on to heroin because it was more readily available and cheaper.
And in 2009, you got a call that no parent wants. Your daughter had overdosed.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
Well, it was an August afternoon. Her mom went home, thankfully, on a afternoon to close the windows because there was an approaching thunderstorm. And as she was walking in the door, Cassie's friends were running out the door. And she found her on the bathroom floor, called me. We dialed 911, and Cassie was purple. Struggling to breathe, needle still on her arm, and I tried to help her breathe as best I could and prayed that the paramedics would get there in time to be able to save her life. Thankfully, in Marinette, assigned to our hospital, we have advanced level EMTs, which are considered paramedics, and under state law at that time, they were allowed to carry naloxone or Narcan and administered it to her, and she came back to life in my arms, and thankfully, she's got a second chance on life. Unfortunately, it put her, actually, unfortunately or fortunately, I guess it depends on your perspective, put her into the correction system. I think that actually saved her life. But, you know, no parent wants their child to end up in prison. But for her, she's been alive in and out of the correction system over the last few years.
You're up there in your part of the state. Obviously, no parent expects this is going to happen. But is this something you ever imagined as a parent seeing?
No. I mean, no. You know, Cassie was a beautiful young girl, bright, smart, had a lot of opportunity for her future, pretty girl, a lot of friends, a natural leader. What we found later, I didn't know at the time the extent of it, but I do now, she had suffered some other very dramatic emotional things in her past. She was sexually assaulted from a young age till about 12 that I wasn't aware of. It was from a close family member on her mom's side of the family. And it's pretty common, I think, for people who have been abused to look for things that can hide that pain and you know, make that pain go away as best as possible. And drug abuse is often a outlet for them.
Well, you've been through this, and your family has been through this harrowing story as private people, as family members. You're a public official. How did this affect the way you legislate and tackle this issue?
Well, I mean, I think early on, it's kind of an embarrassing issue. There's all the gamuts of emotion come into play. Embarrassment, fear, frustration, anger, all those type of things, because nobody, like I said, nobody wants a child that's addicted, and nobody wants that for their child. Mm-hmm. And they don't want it either. So we dealt with it privately the way most families would for a couple of years. And, you know, it was in the newspaper when she got arrested. So it's not like it was completely private, but it's not something we talked about. But when I began to see how big an issue this was, not only for our family, but we were seeing overdose deaths on a regular basis in Marinette, Wisconsin, population 11,000. Marinette County led the state for a couple years in a row in overdose deaths per capita. And, you know, it was a call to action to say, you know, is there something we can do as a legislator to turn this around? I grew up there. It's a community I love. You know, I got a lot of friends there. And there's a lot of emotion and investment tied into that community. So I'm going to do my part to try and fight it. And that's why we decided, with Cassie's support, because we wouldn't have done it without her, because it's her story, not just my story. So, you know, she said yes, and we decided to go public and join the Attorney General in the public service campaign.
I've heard firsthand from local officials, law enforcement, secondhand from some others, when they get that first heroin case, their first overdose, their first arrest, the first thought is here? Really? In our community?
Right. You know, I've traveled the state over the last few months on this issue, from, you know, the big cities to the small towns. I remember being in Southwest Wisconsin a few weeks ago, and, you know, the conversation was, you know, we used to think this part of the state or our small towns was kind of like Mayberry, mm-hmm. you know, with the white picket fence and the perfect life, and, you know, bad things didn't happen. But unfortunately, you know, as I said that day, heroin's in Mayberry now, and our local communities, our parents, our support system didn't expect it to be there. We didn't have the tools to deal with it, and hopefully the state, myself and others are stepping forward and trying to provide some tools that will not eradicate the problem, because it's not going to happen just by a few laws, but make it better so that, you know, we can live to fight another day and try to save some lives.
Well, let's get into some of those efforts. You have a number of pieces of legislation moving toward passage. Overall, you've been calling it the Heroin, Opiate Prevention, and Education, or HOPE agenda. What are some of the key things that are about to become law in Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, a couple of them are just based purely on our experience and what we've learned through talking to other parents. So went home and found Cassie, friends were leaving the home, right? What we've seen anecdotally and read in newspapers and heard on the radio throughout our whole state is young people and citizens are found dead alone from an overdose. There was a young girl in the Milwaukee area who was left in a snowbank. Stories over and over like that. 90% of all people use heroin socially, but unfortunately 90% of all overdose victims are found alone. So they don't want to dial 911 because they're afraid of prosecution. So the 911 Good Samaritan law is a key part of this agenda. The Narcan being allowing for basic level EMTs to be with proper training to be able to carry and administer. That's especially important in a rural area. Those are probably the two start of the legislation that was most significant.
And Narcan is a life or death thing in a lot of cases.
You know, we had a doctor testify in committee that his comment was, nobody dies from Narcan. It's safe. You know, nobody dies from it, but you die if you don't get it, you know, if you're an overdose victim. In addition to those bills, we were working on things such as requiring an ID for narcotics at a pharmacy. You know, that's never been done before in Wisconsin. I could go pick up your drugs, mm-hmm. narcotic drugs, and walk out the door, and nobody would know who I was. So that's difficult for law enforcement to be able to track where the drugs are going.
We're talking with State Representative John Nygren about the heroin-related legislation he's authored to address the opiate addiction problem here in Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think should be done at a state level to help prevent heroin addiction in Wisconsin? What legislation would you like to see stop opiate addiction? And have you or someone close to you suffered from an opiate addiction? How might these heroin bills have made a difference to you or your loved one? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send email to talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation with State Representative John Nygren about his heroin legislation in Wisconsin.
And we're taking your calls. What do you think should be done at a state level to help deal with heroin addiction in the state? Call in at 800-642-1234. Is there something that would have helped you or your family had it been in place? Again, 800-642-1234. We'll go right to your calls now. We've got Jason on the line in Green Lake. Jason, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been a user for some years now, and I live in a small town. And to get the help I needed, I had to go to a methadone clinic, which is over an hour and a half away. If one would have been closer, I may have gone to one a lot sooner. Is there any way of getting these closer to smaller communities?
Jason, thanks for the call.
That's actually, there's seven bills altogether that have passed to date. One of them deals with the treatment alternatives or treatment options in rural and underserved areas. Marinette's, you know, one of those areas. So what we've worked with the Department of Health Services to be able to develop a program, it's going to be a pilot program in two, three, four areas throughout the state where they're going to do some tests to see what really works. Because what we're really looking for is things that can be successful at breaking the cycle of addiction, and then we can replicate them. So they're going to do an abstinence-based treatment program that's pretty consistent with the 12-step program. They're going to do Suboxone, which is drug-assisted treatment, and they're also going to do Vivitrol, which is a drug-assisted treatment, and they're going to do that, and they're going to compare the three at the end of the test, to the end of the pilot, and see what works, and then we're going to utilize that as a way to replicate statewide and make a bigger difference for residents throughout our whole state, not just those three pilot areas.
Jason, thanks for calling. I'm glad you sought out some help, and good luck to you in your recovery. Representative Nygren, what else is on your agenda? We've gotten through most of the pieces of legislation in the HOPE agenda.
Well, I think the treatment is probably the biggest issue moving forward on what can really make a difference. But also another piece has been what we call the rapid response bill that will provide. One of the problems is when somebody gets into the correction system in Marinette and Oconee County, as you said earlier, where I represent, we put about 80 to 100 people into prison over the last 3 to 4 years for heroin and other drug-related offenses, and they get a year sentence, a two-year sentence. They come home, and to date, this is not a proud statistic, but to date, 100% of those folks have reoffended and gone back to prison. So if the objective of our state with the correction system is to rehabilitate someone, we're failing miserably. And I'm the co-chairman of the state's finance committee. We set the budget. So I'm in charge of I'm at the bean counter. Mm-hmm. That's a bad investment that we're making. We need to find things that can work and be successful at actually breaking the cycle. And we found some things that have worked in other states. It's called Swift and Certain model legislation. We're calling it rapid response. But in states that have implemented it, they've seen the recidivism rate go down as much as 70%.
Wow. That's a big difference.
It is. And we're hoping. I mean, we are grasping to a certain extent, but we're looking for things that can work.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Becky on the line in Janesville. Becky, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, I am a parent of a heroin addict. She is actually out in Colorado at the time. We have rehabbed her twice. She has now in the last year since she's been in Colorado been in and out of jail probably 10 to 15 times. They seem to keep letting her out. She does the same offenses. She gets picked up. They hold her for a week. She goes to court. She's back out again on the streets. It happens again. And it's the same thing over and over. And I guess I don't understand when enough is enough and they just hold her. I mean, I'm just frustrated because we can't help. We don't know what to do.
Becky, thank you. Good luck to you and your daughter. Representative Nygren, that illustrates what you were just talking about.
It does. And unfortunately, one of the aspects of this effort has been I've heard from, you know, a lot of parents and folks throughout the state who have lost loved ones. So I guess I would just say to Becky, there's still hope that perhaps you can intervene or that your loved one, you know, hits that rock bottom point where they decide that they, you know, they need to, you know, change their course of their life. In my daughter's case, it's a day-to-day thing that she'll deal with the rest of her life, and every addict will. You know, once an addict, you're always an addict, and it's a lifelong battle. So, you know, keep praying, keep trying to get her to be the right place that can actually turn her life around.
I think back to the 1980s and the crack cocaine epidemic, and if somebody was interviewing a state or federal lawmaker at that time, almost all the answers we would have been hearing were crime and punishment related, three strikes legislation, longer jail sentences. That seems very different this time around.
We, you know what? It was all, hey, I'm an elected official, I understand. I mean, tough on crime, harsh on crime penalties were popular with the elected officials because they were popular with the public. We thought that was a way that that was the best way to deal with these type of issues. What we found is, as the stats I just gave you, it's not working. So if you want to keep doing the same thing over and over again with zero results, that's ridiculous. So let's look for some things that can work. And, you know, I think that'll be a better investment because moving forward, first of all, our population is shrinking, the young people. I mean, we're all aging. The largest segment of the population is aging. Mm-hmm. We're not going to have enough people in the workforce. So what are we going to do if we're going to basically wash our hands of anybody who's an addict or maybe anybody who's had a felony in their past and say they're not going to be a productive citizen? That's a huge expense to our state and our society. I would prefer to say, let's give these people an opportunity to turn their lives around and become productive taxpaying citizens that actually can contribute to society rather than being a drain on society.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Judy on the line in Soldiers Grove. Judy, hi.
Hi. I am a recovering alcoholic, and I do understand the stigma involved with any type of addiction, and it seems like it always seems to go in the direction of it being a matter of choice, when in actuality it is a mental illness. I was totally sane in many of my aspects of life, but when it came to the addiction, I was insane, and keep trying to do the same thing over and over and getting the same results is a definition of insanity. And I just wish so badly that somehow it could be turned away from the stigma from being a criminal or a bad person to this is a mental illness that needs to be treated as such.
Thanks, Judy. Representative Nygren.
I think society's changing on this issue. And you know, politically, when I decided to take on this issue, I was concerned about how my constituents would perceive this. Are you being soft on crime? What I found is I'm overwhelmingly a strong support for this. I mean, almost to a person. And I think the reason that is because just like with mental illness, and I agree with Judy, there's a connection here in almost every case, you know, with mental illness. Everybody has someone, whether it be a loved one, a friend, a neighbor, someone at their church, someone they work with that has been affected by addiction or mental health issues. And because of that, I think our attitudes are beginning to change. And I'm excited about that. That gives us an opportunity to truly do some things that will make a difference.
Thanks a lot for the call, Judy. We've got Debbie now in Waukesha on the line. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I am so excited about this this topic and listening to this on the radio here. I have been a substance abuse counselor for the last 33 years, so I've seen a lot over the years. I'm also a recovering addict myself. 34 years, so I wanted to save the world and got in there right after I got clean and sober, but of course we can't do that. But my point I want to make is that we need to go back to some days where we have long-term treatment. You know, people are going in for 2 weeks of treatment, or they're going into outpatient, or they're going into halfway house programs that are 3 months, and they are not enough to make a dent in this problem. We need long-term treatment. When I go back into the early 80s and remember the residential programs that were back then, you know, we could keep people. We had funding where we could keep people up to a year. And the success rate, you know, I still know people from back then and quite a few who are clean and sober today. You know, I think we got to look at the pharmaceutical companies. I think we've got to look at you know, this whole criminal justice.
Debbie, thanks a lot for the call. I want to give Representative Nygren time to respond to that. Any hope of longer-term care being available?
Well, I mean, the treatment, I mean, I'll rely to the – or defer to the treatment specialists and experts about that. But that's, I guess, one of the things I would point back to that swift and certain or that rapid response is this is an ongoing program that's going to help people not just while they're in the 60, 90, 120-day program, but – help them move beyond even that treatment program into day-to-day life where they can, you know, have a job, you know, raise their family, and, you know, live the life that everybody expects all of us to live, but have some help as they're doing it and some parameters to help them get there. And I'm from what I've seen in other states, it's proven to be successful. So I'm really very excited about seeing how that works here in Wisconsin.
Briefly, Representative Nygren, just having the conversations we've had this last couple of days, I'm worried about this. Are you hopeful? Are we going to turn the corner on this anytime soon?
I'm excited about where we are at because we're having the conversation. You know, I think that's probably one of the things that has impressed me the most about this is the number of people who, you know, your phones light up when you talk about this subject. When I go out in public and talk to a group, the number of people that come up to me and tell me their story. In the past, my family, other families, we were afraid to talk about this because we thought we had done something wrong, that our kids were screwed up, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But I'm most excited about the fact that people are identifying that this is a real problem.
Thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you.
That's John Nygren, Republican State Representative for the 89th Assembly District.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrer. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Republicans are hoping to win a majority in the U.S. Senate this fall. USA Today's Paul Singer will join us to highlight some key races.
First, Toyota Motor Corporation has agreed to pay a $1.2 billion settlement in a U.S. Justice Department probe into its handling of safety problems.
Attorney General Eric Holder called the payment the largest criminal penalty imposed on a car company in U.S. history. This comes on the heels of a recall announcement from GM, which just appointed a new safety director. John McElroy is with us. He's host of the webcast Autoline Daily and the television program Autoline This Week. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Why is the Justice Department hitting Toyota so hard on this?
Well, really, it was not so much the defect that they're getting hit with. It was the fact that they hid this, and they hid it for years. They really tried to stonewall the Justice Department. So this $1.2 billion settlement is really as much as punitive charges as it is anything else.
So it's not the crime, it's sort of the cover-up.
It really is.
Can you take us back? This was a September 2009 recall over accelerator issues. Remind us what happened there.
Sure. There were some very visible cases, tragically involving fatalities, where Toyota cars, or Lexus, you know, which is also a brand that Toyota has, would seemingly go out of control, would not be able to brake the car and bring it to a stop. On thorough investigation, it was found that in some cases, the floor mats could jam up under the gas pedal and prevent it from decelerating. They also found that there were some what they called sticky gas pedals, where if you push the gas pedal down, it would not come up. There was definitely a defect in that. There were also allegations that were largely disproved that somehow electronic gremlins in the computer were making these cars run out of control. That's been pretty much debunked. Nonetheless, the fact that Toyota continued to stonewall and not report this is really what got it into trouble.
How much damage did this cause financially, and how many people died or were injured as a result of the real accelerated issues you just talked about?
Well, that's hard to figure out how many fatalities were caused by this defect, i.e. the floor mats getting jammed up under there or the sticky gas pedals. There's also this concept of unintended acceleration. It's been around a long time. Audi faced a big problem on this, which has largely been proved to be driver error. People really think they're pushing down on the brake when, in fact, they're pushing on the accelerator. And it's very difficult to determine which was a driver making a mistake or a defect in the car. It's not impossible to find this out, but I have not seen any breakdown between fatalities caused by the defect or fatalities caused by driver error. Getting back to your question, though, of how much this cost Toyota, it cost a lot. In addition to the $1.2 billion, Toyota's actually had to put out a whole lot more money. They faced a class action lawsuit for people who own Toyotas who said, geez, even if my car was not involved in the recall, because it is a Toyota, it has lost value. That class action lawsuit cost Toyota $1.6 billion. On top of that was the cost of the recall itself, of bringing all these cars in, 10 million of them, if I remember right. And on top of that, of course, there's Toyota had to pay all its lawyers, the cost of that litigation. It had to come up with marketing campaigns. It had to add sales incentives. Some analysts believe this cost Toyota as much as $5 billion.
So is the lesson here, jump on these things early. Don't worry about the PR. Try to tackle that safety issue head on.
That's really it. The message in this is, if you're a corporation with some sort of product defect, come clean. Jump on it right away. Get it out. I mean, the courts will go a whole lot easier on you. I believe if Toyota had dealt with this in a forthright manner, it still would have cost the company money, but it would not be getting hit by a $1.2 billion fine from the Department of Justice.
From Toyota to General Motors now, more recalls issued yesterday, I think it was, and General Motors appointed a new, in effect, safety czar, a high-level official charged with maintaining safety issues in their cars. What's the latest on General Motors?
Well, Rob, I think everything that we just discussed with Toyota is kind of a dry run for what General Motors is about to go through. It had a safety defect in its ignition switches on a number of different models that over time could lead the ignition switch to turn off if it got jostled or bumped. Just going over a bumpy road could do it, which would turn off the engine, which would disable everything, including preventing the airbags from deploying if the car got in an accident. General Motors knew about this problem well over a decade ago. In fact, GM's own engineers caught this problem fairly early on, came up with a very simple and inexpensive fix, and yet nobody in management would approve this. And now we're going to find out why. Was this someone who was involved in those programs trying to protect their career, or was this just bureaucracy and red tape run amok and nothing could get through the system?
And this could end up being as expensive, maybe even more expensive for GM than the Toyota case.
Easily as expensive as the Toyota case.
And what, looking ahead now, GM was on the road to recovery, it seemed like, after a big slump near bankruptcy, or they went through bankruptcy, am I right?
They did. They absolutely did.
So now what does this mean for GM's recovery?
Well, look, this is going to be expensive. It's going to be very painful. But, you know, we were just talking about Toyota. 3 years ago, Toyota was going through this. Mm-hmm. Today, its sales and market share are going strong. In fact, when Toyota reports its fiscal earnings at the end of this month, it's likely to report a net profit of $19 billion. Now, General Motors is in not nearly that good a financial shape, but this will not kill the company. It's clearly something it did not want to go through. Here is an American icon that's been trying to gain public perception and credibility with the American public. This is a big setback for it. But again, it's not as if this is going to push the company back into bankruptcy.
Lessons for other car companies watching, I'm sure, very closely watching these cases.
Well, and I've talked to a number of other car companies, Rob, and they all say, we're not saying anything about this because there, but for the grace of God, go we. You never know when something like this is going to pop up. You know, defects are not at all unusual in the automotive industry. Honest to goodness, there's literally a recall every single week. The problem is when these recalls or these defects lead to fatalities, and even worse is when somehow or other the company covered it up.
Is there a lesson here for consumers when people are shopping for a car? Is there anything they can do to protect themselves?
Well, there is. There really is. You know, there's lots of users online reporting about their experience with their car or whatever consumer product it happens to be. And you can, if you're serious about looking into buying a car, whether a new one or a used one, is get online and find some of these groups that are on there sharing their experiences. You might find that one vehicle is better than another. You might be tipped off that if you really do have your heart set on getting one vehicle, you might look out for X, Y, or Z about it.
All right. Thanks a lot for joining us today, John.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That was John McElroy, host of the webcast Autoline Daily and the television program Autoline This Week. Paul Singer of USA Today joins us now for our weekly look at the latest from Congress. Both houses are off this week, but there's still plenty to talk about. Republicans are hoping to take control of the Senate in this fall's elections, and there's some ethics news coming down the pipeline.
Paul Singer is the Politics and Congress editor at USA Today. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Veronica. How are you doing?
Doing okay. Well, Wisconsin is sitting out this fall's election, but there's still a lot happening, a lot at stake in November. Now, Republicans are hoping to retake control, but before we look at the particular races, how confident are they that they'll flip the Senate to GOP control in 2014?
Well, I think they're increasingly confident, in part because they continue to believe that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is a very unpopular program, and that they can run a pretty strong campaign saying that Obamacare is bad for you and the Democrats want to keep it. And that has so far proven to be a pretty good message for them, and the Democrats are still trying to figure out a good response. In many cases, the response of the Democrats is to argue that basically, well, we're in favor of it, but not entirely in favor of it. It wasn't entirely our idea. Sure, there's some things we could change, which is just not as powerful a message as it's bad, it wasn't our idea, vote the guys out.
Is there any evidence so far, early evidence, that line of aligning yourself with or against Obamacare is going to pay off one way or the other?
Well, the first evidence we got, again, evidence is sort of hard to say because this is still several months away, obviously, but the first indication we got was a couple, I guess, last week. I've lost track of my days. In the Florida special election for a House seat that in a district that had voted for Obama but had a Republican member of Congress who passed away, leaving an open seat, and the Republican won that race. Again, very much hammering on this message that Obamacare is bad for you and the Democrats like it. And the Republicans think that's a great signal for them winning that election because it suggests the problems the Democrats are going to have in the fall making this case.
Now, obviously, there's a fair chunk of months between now and November, but looking ahead, do you see a chance of Republicans getting the full 60-vote filibuster-proof majority?
Probably not 60, but there is a pretty good chance they can get to 51, which is all they need to really gum up the works for any of President Obama's proposals. I doubt they could get a veto-proof filibuster, veto-proof margin, but control of the Senate means you control the debate, and all you need is 51, and that they only need to win. I guess they need to take 6 seats from the Democrats. And there are more than a dozen in play where they could make up those seats they need.
Well, let's look at some of the races coming up. Which ones are you watching? Which ones are key?
Well, you know, the biggest races, I think, obviously, the ones that the Democrat is considered most endangered would be Arkansas, a guy named Mark Pryor, and Louisiana, Senator Mary Landrieu. Both of them are Democrats running in states that have voted heavily for Republicans in recent years, including last year's 2012 presidential election. Kay Hagan in North Carolina may also be a vulnerable Democrat. And then in the past couple of weeks, there's been some new races that have gotten interesting. We didn't think they were going to be interesting, but they've gotten interesting. For instance, Scott Brown, who you may remember was briefly a senator from Massachusetts, a Republican senator from Massachusetts, who had taken Ted Kennedy's seat. He is no longer in the Senate, is a private citizen, and he moved to New Hampshire. And he's now going to run, or he says he's going to run, as a Republican candidate for the Senate in New Hampshire against Democrat Jeanne Shaheen. Even if he doesn't win, that makes another state where there is a high-profile Republican. It's going to attract a lot of attention and cost Democrats money to defend that seat.
And another interesting race, which has gotten, I guess, even more interesting, is Colorado with Cory Gardner and Ken Buck.
Correct. And you know, again, here's where you have, particularly with the entrance of Cory Gardner into this race against Mark Udall, that was a race that Udall was expected to be able to carry pretty easily, well, you know, reasonably easily anyhow. Cory Gardner is seen as a very strong statewide candidate and a good recruit for the Republicans. And again, it makes that race much more interesting and much more competitive. That is another place where Democrats will have to spend money to defend a seat. And there are very few places on the map where they can go and get a seat that Republicans currently hold.
Now, as I understand it, in Colorado, there was a bit of messiness and unpleasantness as Ken Buck was replaced with Cory Gardner. Is that going to have any effect on the race?
No, I kind of doubt it. I mean, there's a lot of internal bruising that goes on in choosing candidates in any party, because obviously we're hurting the feelings of our friends when we choose ourselves over them. But ultimately, this is going to be a race, I suspect, once again, about some of the issues that have been powerful in Colorado, guns being one of them. Keep in mind that this is a state that held a recall election for several state senators who supported gun control, new gun registration requirements, and they were basically kicked out of office. So it's a state that Democrats have a hard time with sometimes.
Looking at a bigger picture, sort of the emerging identity of the Republican Party, do you have a sense what role the Tea Party might play in that November election?
You know, that's a really interesting question. The Tea Party at the moment is in a bit of a battle with other establishment Republicans. And so where they're likely to have their biggest impact, if they're going to have one at all, is going to be in the primaries in a couple of very red states like Georgia. There is a Republican primary going on there where the competition is really to see who can be the most conservative Republican in the race. You will see them in South Carolina trying to attack Senator Lindsey Graham for not being conservative enough. But at the moment, they don't appear to be winning a bunch of these races. I mean, there was a pretty high-profile race in Texas where the Senator Cornyn, who's been around a long time, well-respected Republican Party, had a Tea Party challenger who amounted to very little in the end. So I think where you might see the Tea Party play in a meaningful way is going to be in some of these primaries, but I'm not sure it'll matter all that much once the candidates are chosen and we go to November.
And with that in mind, do you think it's going to matter much that there doesn't seem to be, at least not at this point, a real solid identity, a cohesiveness in the Republican Party yet?
Well, as long as they stick to the message that Obama and Democrats are bad, and Obamacare particularly is bad, that is their cohesiveness. No matter where you stand on gun control or abortion or gay rights or some of the other issues that divide the Republican Party, they're pretty much unified on Obamacare is bad. And as long as they stick to that message, they have that cohesion, that's what they're going to run on.
And before we leave the topic of the November elections, what about Democrats? Any hopes in the Assembly, for instance?
Well, you know, they're not likely to take the House representatives back at this point. They'd have to win, you know, 25 seats from Republicans. I don't think that's going to happen. There's just, again, there's not a wave going on that's pushing in the Democrats' favor in the House representatives. And the way districts have been created over the years, they're pretty safe for both parties. If your party has controlled that seat for a little while, you're pretty much locked in. There's only a handful of seats that are really close enough to swing back and forth across the parties. And at this point, a bunch of Democrats have retired, which is, again, seats that they're probably going to lose or have to fight to keep. So there's not a lot of hope that Democrats are going to win back the House of Representatives.
Now let's move on to another area you've been watching lately, ethics in Congress. Now, you've been reporting on the ethics issue in the House involving our neighbor to the south, Illinois. Can you fill us in on what's happening there?
Yeah, that's my favorite topic. Yeah, there is, we believe, an ethics investigation that it will be announced this week. There are against a congressman named Luis Gutierrez from Chicago. Gutierrez is pretty well known because he is a very high-profile advocate of immigration reform for the House Democrats. We believe that the House Ethics Committee is going to announce that they're looking into allegations that he improperly had a Chicago lobbyist basically on his payroll in his congressional office. That's a story that we wrote at USA Today last summer. We discovered this guy had been paid somewhere in the range of $500,000 over the course of 10 years to advise the congressman while at the same time running a public affairs and lobbying firm in Chicago. We think that's a no-no. We are relatively certain that the Ethics Committee is investigating it because we saw a bunch of legal fees that the congressman was paying out to people who specialize in ethics investigations, lawyers who specialize in ethics investigations. And so we think that's going to be announced sometime in the next couple of days.
Okay, that's interesting. So Gutierrez hasn't been talking about this, but we've been seeing the legal bills mounting. Why has it taken this long to break?
Oh, well, that's the beauty of the way the congressional ethics process works. Things take forever. In this particular case, one of the reasons we think that it is the case is a Gutierrez case is that the thing was delayed. The House Ethics Committee can't actually say anything about any kind of investigation of anybody who's on a ballot in the next 60 days. Well, that meant that they were ready to have this case, to announce this case 60 days ago, but the Illinois primary was Tuesday, yesterday. So they couldn't announce anything for 60 days before it. They had to wait. So we think they're going to announce tomorrow.
Okay. So as soon as the primary's over, the things
are rolling
again.
Now the primary's over. Now they can talk.
Well, stepping back from that case, you also note that a Congressional Ethics Review Board recently marked its five-year anniversary. What was new about that review panel?
Well, this is the panel that Nancy Pelosi created when she was Speaker, sort of the one of the new reforms of that Congress, was to create a panel that would, independent panel that would sort of vet ethics concerns and forward them to the Ethics Committee for action. And the whole idea was the Ethics Committee did a lot of stuff that nobody ever saw. It was totally behind closed doors. It was never clear anybody was actually being punished. This board creates transparency, and it creates a way for someone like me to look at their reports and say, hey, there's an ethics investigation that's about to come out, and I can track it back and figure out it's Gutierrez. That is a direct result of this new panel. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that anybody gets punished or any more meaningful punishment, but it does mean that we are able to see that members of Congress are, in fact, being investigated for ethics concerns.
All right. We'll leave it there. Paul, thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely my pleasure, Veronica. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. That was Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us each week at this time to bring us up to date on the latest from Congress.